Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to Listening to Young Voices on Climate Change, Flight Shame, Limitations in the UK Education System, The Temporal Nature of Getting Your Coffee Down Under, amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great! Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Coffee and Geography. So I am joined by a really good friend of mine who we've worked at a distance because of this post-COVID way of working and things like that. And it feels like we've known each other forever, doesn't it? Catherine Walker, it feels like we have.
Oh, yeah, it's lovely. Really lovely to be here, Kit. Thanks so much for welcoming me.
Yeah, so Catherine Walker is a human geographer researcher at Newcastle University, known as Catherine by some, Kate to others, but to everyone, known as a deep thinker with a passion for exploring, analysing, reading and writing about how young people relate to climate and environmental issues and how that looks and feels different in different parts of the world. So this interest is semi-autobiographical, which we will discuss, but also informed by a master's PhD and a postdoctoral research in the United Kingdom, India, Australia, and Brazil. So if there's any candidate, Catherine, who is very suited to this podcast, despite the spill of the beans we'll talk about later, you're definitely a prime candidate. So yeah, you've been around the world a bit.
I have, yes. Doing a languages degree helps with that for sure. Part of the reason I did a languages degree, so I studied Spanish and Portuguese as my undergrad, was just because it gave me the excuse to spend a year in Latin America. And even before I went to uni, I spent a year in Chile as well, which again was very easy to justify because I was going on to study Spanish at uni. So yeah, the languages was a great start in terms of traveling, but yeah, the traveling interest has always been there. And now as an academic researcher, I get to do research with partners in various parts of the world and possibly not travel as much as I think maybe academic researchers used to in the past. I mean, I do think that's a discussion that needs to be had, you know, kind of the whole sort of, you know, the hypocrisy, I guess, of sort of sometimes researching climate issues and, you know, going off to a conference on the other side of the world. I think that is happening a lot less.
Yeah.
But there's still opportunities to spend sort of a longer embedded amount of time in other countries, sort of engaged in research. So I've basically, yeah, just kind of marked out a career path for myself that allows me to keep, if not traveling myself, at least talking to and researching with people in all parts of the world.
Yeah. And the debate, I think that's always a debate that's never really going to be closed, is the whole traveling for research, for education and things like that, because we know that research, education, you know, are, and talking about things like climate change, environmental things, like especially in person, is like very impactful and very powerful, you know. So it's one of those really kind of like tricky issues, isn't it, to discuss, where you think, well, if we didn't go out and we went physically to Antarctica, which is quite carbon intensive, to do all these studies, to go to all these different parts of the world, to go and meet people for purely scientific, academic and educational purposes, then we would not have the knowledge, understanding and growth in order to combat environmental issues like we do. So I think probably everybody listening can agree that scientists flying to Antarctica and the carbon that takes is far more justifiable than some ultra high worth individual jumping on a private jet to go to his third, fourth, fifth home somewhere. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think I'm all about sort of bringing together different objectives with travel as well. Mm. My last major research project was partly in Melbourne, and my sister has lived in Melbourne for 17 years. And I mean, I'd be lying if I said that wasn't a motivator to want to go and spend 3 months in Melbourne.
You know, oh, of course, yeah.
There were, you know, good intellectual reasons for doing the research out there, but there was the family commitment too. And, you know, I think increasingly that's maybe we all just kind of need to sort of have a few places that we know that we're going to prioritize, and we're not just going there for a conference or, you know, something that only lasts a few days. We're able to, yeah, if possible, kind of, you know, bring a few things together. There's a researcher called Danny Miller. He's an anthropologist at UCL, and he's written this book called Consumption and Its Consequences. And he actually talks about sort of carbon miles as being like love miles, you know, because when we, you know, in a globalized world, so many people I know have family and loved ones in other parts of the world. And that's, you know, that's the one thing, if anything, you can do a conference online, but you can't spend time with loved ones in the same way. So I think it's just, you know, as much as possible, if you can sort of bring those purposes together.
Yeah. And I've got family in the States, as you know, and a lot of people listening know. And, you know, we've just bought tickets to fly from Heathrow to Denver in October to go and see our family, you know, and they're not. Yeah. And then you kind of, on one side, you've got this, you know, this new term that came out a few years ago, like flagsham, which is like, was it, it's Iceland, I think it's Icelandic, or it's some kind of Nordic for flight shame, you know. So I have that all the time, like when I fly to go and see family. But I'm thinking, like, I have not stepped on a plane for, I'm struggling to remember a time I stepped on a plane purely for holiday purposes, to a location where there was no connections, you know, no family, no friends. So I know people maybe listen, well, you're still trying to justify flying and all that things, Kit, but yeah, I mean, it's tricky when I think the way I look at it is that as geographers, most geographers I speak to, if not all geographers I speak to, kind of embrace the fact that we're a global society, because it enriches our humanity, it enriches our culture, it gives a hell of a lot of sparkle and enjoyment and wonder and awe to learn about the world. But that comes at this cost, that of course a globalized world means the movement of information worldwide, and that's not just physical people from one place to another, that's also the energy it costs to move technology around and to transmit. So like, even when I'm having a Zoom call with family and friends in the United States, there's some carbon element to that as well. So it's which is why I'm very on board with the whole, you know, the targeting the kind of disproportionate element of environmental destruction and carbon intensive activities, you know, like private jets flying to COP, you know, for example. France considering banning domestic flights, for example. You know, but in return, they're trying to improve the rail infrastructure instead. So, you know, that kind of stuff, absolutely. And crikey, if I could get a high speed carbon negative or neutral rail across the Atlantic, then I would, you know, sleeper train or something, but it doesn't exist at the moment. So, but yeah, but we're going off on a tangent already. So, but this is kind of things that Catherine and I talk about quite a lot, actually, folks. We have intellectual discussions.
And it's addressing the elephant in the room, like straight up.
Oh,
isn't
yeah.
It? You know,
yeah,
you just got to do that.
Yeah. And on this podcast, people know that the elephant is always welcome in this podcast.
Okay. So brilliant.
We don't, yeah.
Please tell me.
I'm going to ask a very different, in terms of the brews that you drink. I'm going to ask it this a very differently, the way I usually different. Usually I just say, okay, what are you drinking right now? Tell us about it. But what I want, because you've been to various places, you know, Australia in particular, but I'm going to say, is there, okay, I'm going to word this carefully. So did you have like a very specific brew that you always went to in each individual location? Or were you the kind of person who was like pining for a specific thing, home comfort, no matter where you went? So what was your drinking habits like, basically, when your non-alcoholic drinking habits as you were traveling around the world?
I mean, say Melbourne, just absolutely fantastic coffee, amazing coffee. So Melbourne has this history of Italian immigration, and the first coffee shops in Melbourne were opened by Italians, and you know, really, really good quality. And it's just kept really good quality coffee. I mean, you can, you know, you can get a coffee in like McDonald's or Subway, or and it will be fairly standard, but any specific coffee shop will have, you know, really, really good quality, like barista style coffee. So, I mean, where I stayed in Melbourne when I was doing the research that I did sort of 2022, I was actually at Melbourne University, which, as you can imagine, just has tons of coffee shops around it. And so I was just really spoiled by which one I went to each day. There is an interesting thing with the sort of temporality of coffee in Melbourne, in that it's almost impossible to find a good quality coffee after 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
They will open early. A lot of coffee shops will open at 6:30 and they'll be closing up around 2:30. And because they say, people in Melbourne say that because the wages are really, really good for baristas, because they really prioritize, you know, good quality coffee making, they really train everyone up. Basically, they can only afford to pay them at the high wage that they get for, you know, certain number of hours per day. So that's why they close so early. But for someone who's used to kind of heading out at 5 p.m., you know, just to kind of get a coffee to keep going, it could be a bit tricky. Yeah, so, I mean, Melbourne was definitely all about the coffee. But then I also did, I mean, speaking about tea, did part of my PhD research in India. So there it was all about the chai, which was fantastic. You know, we went to people's homes and had interviews. We were actually doing interviews in people's homes, and there would always be a point midway through the interview or sometimes before where, you know, the chai would come out and then you could barely concentrate on what the interview was.
Yeah, yeah.
The chai was so good. And I mean, sort of as like someone who was, you know, kind of not used to the water, etc., and kind of, you know, having to be sort of quite careful health-wise, I always went for the chai option because it was, you know, it's been boiled for hours and hours, filled up with all those lovely spices. So my Indian co-researcher sort of said right from the start, like, Catherine, it's all right, you can have the chai. That won't, you know, that's not going to affect you. So yeah, just got really into the chai there, and also tulsi tea, which is
okay,
good for everything. Yeah, really, like, really kind of energizing, really good for digestion. So yeah, got really into the tulsi tea when I was in India.
Nice. Yeah, my one of my fondest memories recording this podcast was when I was interviewing the actor Adil Hussain in the first season, and as I was speaking to him, this kind of like tray of like tea just like appeared just out of shot onto him, and he was like, "Oh, sorry, Kit, my wife's just brought me some Assam." I'm like, and he just had this little like segue about talk about it, and he was just like, he's like, "Yeah, look at the color," and everything like that. And then I had this like big period like after for a few months, like just trying to drink Assam tea, you know, especially like the, you know, the proper, there were some coffee shops around here that would actually have it, you know, loose leaf, which was nice. But it's never going to be the same. And he is actually from the Assam. He's from Goalpara, which is you know, that's the place. So he says that's where I'm from. He lives in New Delhi now, but he never drinks hardly anything, you know, drinks Assam tea, really nothing else. So it's just mind that memory like pinged up as you were talking about, yeah, like you're having this academic interview and stuff, and then people say something, no, it's the tea.
And not just tea, it's snacks as well.
Really
nice sweets and savory snacks and things.
Oh, that's wonderful. So we're mentioning a place right now. So you know, mentioning India and Australia in particular, and of course here in UK. So you're based in Newcastle at the moment, but not too long ago you were in Manchester, which is when I got to know you. So coming up to Manchester, and then when we worked on that project, which we'll very briefly talk about in a minute. So you've kind of been quite nomadic in a way, I guess. So Yeah, I love this question because it always gives people a chance to think a bit, perhaps something in a way that they haven't thought before, is that, you know, for all the places that you've been to, Catherine, and what do you feel, how do you think place has kind of like informed your identity? Kind of like, how has, you know, what part of your soul and your essence is kind of like British or Australian, or maybe did you bring back a piece of India with you, you know? So how has the place you visited, how's place kind of like informed your identity?
Oh, wow, that's a brilliant question. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because you said at the start, sort of, I come across as quite nomadic and, you know, I've lived in lots of places, been really, really privileged to sort of have opportunities to travel. But yeah, I mean, where I grew up was sort of not particularly cosmopolitan. I mean, I grew up in rural Cheshire, where my parents still live. And in some ways sort of quite a sheltered existence, I would say. I mean, we would go to Chester as the nearest city, Manchester, Liverpool, kind of bigger cities. I think I first went to London when I was about 11, and that was, you know, that seemed really exciting. My sister and I were talking about this the other day, that we wanted to go to the Hard Rock Cafe of all places, you know, the sort of typical, yep, like sort, yep, of, you know, teenage things that you want to do. Yeah, but so it's sort of quite sheltered sort of in some ways. And the first time I left Europe was on my, again, this is such a privileged thing to do, my gap year, pre-university, when I went to Chile. But so sort of one extreme to the other, really, because I hadn't been outside of Europe before. I'd only sort of, you know, sort of travelled for very short amounts of time, really. And then I committed to this 1 year in Chile, which was an 18-hour flight. And I was doing this sort of year of volunteering in a primary school in the south of Chile, sort of quite an indigenous area. But the organisation that I went with was quite strict about sort of contact with home, with family. And this was 2002. So I think now it would be a lot more difficult to sort of, you know, to kind of control this. And I mean, they couldn't control it, but we were sort of told basically, like, throw yourself into the experience, throw yourself into the place, and write letters, you know, write emails, write, you know, so you'll have that account of sort of the year, which actually I'm thankful for now, because I have still got all those letters I sent to my parents. But, you know, I spoke to my parents, I think, about four times over that year. So, wow. I mean, that was just, you know, from one extreme to the other, but really, really sort of embedding myself in that place, which in some ways, I mean, was very different. Obviously different language and multiple languages, actually, because there was also the indigenous language of the region, which some of the children in school still spoke. And, you know, different, I went from northern to some of the southern hemisphere. Climate, not so different in the south of Chile, you know, pretty cold in the winter. But then, yeah, so then there were these kind of similarities as well. I was still in quite sort of a rural area, and used to sort of go to the city at the weekends and things. So, yeah, sort of similarities and differences. But, I mean, as a first place to sort of spend a sustained amount of time, it was just amazing, really, because it was I arrived sort of in August 2002, and September is a really big month in Chile because it's the Independence Day celebrations. Oh, okay. And so that was all kind of building up. But again, doing it in this region where sort of independence has a different meaning, because there's these sort of ongoing land struggles between the indigenous people and you know, the sort of the dominant population. So just and so that local kind of heritage and pride was coming out too. So sorry, I really am rambling now.
Which is so interesting. No, please go. Yeah.
But yeah, so that was my first sustained experience, as I say, of kind of living away from home. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't identify as a geographer then. I was there, as I said before, you know, because I was going on to study Spanish at university. But so much of what I got interested in that year, looking back now, I think, yeah, I was a geographer all along. I just didn't know it. And then, of course, we had the opportunity to travel around Chile and went to the far south, the Torres del Paine National Park, did a hike there and sort of crossed over into Peru and Argentina. And just an amazing thing with Chile is sort of you travel up and down the country, but you can often, if you're traveling north to south and you sort of look over to over to the east, you will always see the Andes. They call it La Cordillera, like the sort of the spine of the country. So it's just such an incredible country, you know, to travel around. And yeah, that really, I think that has shaped the rest of my life, basically. Mm. I know that sounds dramatic, but to go somewhere as an 18-year-old when you're like a sponge for information and just new experiences, I do think I'm still spending the rest of my life kind of almost sort of trying to replicate that experience of just like, wow, the world is amazing and, you know, similar and different in different places. And yeah, it's, yeah, so places and travel have been really, really important.
Wow. And what an experience at such an age. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I know.
About the same, in fact, the same year, I think it was the same year, 2002. Yeah, I did summer in Camp America in upstate New York. And that was an experience which eventually led me to think of becoming a teacher. So, but no, you're right. I mean, it does sound cliche. Of course it does. But I think really, if people do fundamentally think about it, you know, you can pin quite life-changing, you know, instances to a moment or just a short period of time. You know, I mean, me going to Malawi was one for sure. Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco, you know, a few years ago.
Hey, educators! If you teach any geography, environmental or human or physical science-based topics, then check out Kit Marie Rackley's website at geogramblings.com. There you will find musings, blogs, resources, analyses, and more. Perhaps you want to brush up, learn, or dig deeper into a geographical issue? Or you're looking for a resource you can use in the classroom? Or maybe looking for someone with an award-winning, diverse expertise and skill set to collaborate with you on a project? Kit Marie offers free 30-minute friendly consultations if you're looking to brainstorm ideas. Jog on to geogramblings.com to explore and find out more.
You painted that picture about traveling through Chile like so beautifully. Like you can just imagine that, you know, you peer to the east, you see the mountains, and then you peer to the west. You might not be able to see the Pacific Ocean, but you know it's there. So you've got kind of like this kind of, you're in almost like this geographical, like, I'm trying to think conceptually, like in mentally, you're in this valley, aren't you? Where you're kind of like the mountains on one side and the ocean on the other. And so yeah, that must be an experience.
Yeah, I mean, even though I didn't identify as a geographer at the time, I mean, for a geographer, it's just such a fascinating country because it's so long and thin. You know, it begins with the driest desert on Earth, the Atacama, and then ends in glaciers. And,
right. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Like, what other country can you sort of pack so much geographical diversity within, you know, such a compact landmass? It's just an incredible country to travel in.
Yeah, absolute spot. Yeah, the Atacama, some parts of the Atacama Desert, it hasn't precipitated at all for over 100 years or something, isn't it? That's incredible. There's hardly a human alive on this planet, you know, when it last precipitated or rained in the Atacama Desert, and that just blows my mind, you know, those kind of facts. But it's its own ecosystem. It still thrives, you know, it exists. Yeah. It still has
the flowering, isn't there? Like,
yeah,
it's
still flowering. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's so incredible. So, you know, life finds a way. But you, as you say, you it's funny because you didn't consider yourself as a geographer, and you kind of like historian by, we'll come back to a bit later, historian by, but you do work in a geography department.
I do, yeah, I do sometimes still get imposter syndrome. and this is, I mean, again, talking about elephants in the room, I just thought I would be really upfront and kind of make a point of this, that, you know, my big kind of disclosure is that I don't actually have a geography degree.
No.
Even though I now, as you say, work in a geography department, and in time, I mean, currently I'm on a research only contract, but in time I'm going to be teaching, and I have done a year of university teaching. I do sometimes still get imposter syndrome, because I think, well, you know, I didn't do, you know, a geography degree.
Didn't even take it in GCSE, yeah.
Which I know, I just think, gosh, loads of people are going to turn off now.
No.
She's not a real geographer. She didn't do geography.
No, I think they're actually thinking, ha ha, we've got another convert, ha.
Well, yeah, that's a nice way of looking at it. So that's a gracious way of looking at it. But I mean, I absolutely love geography now. But I do think it's part of the schooling system that, you know, we're forced to make choices early. Yeah. You know, and having to choose, I mean, I know this may not be the case everywhere, but a lot of kids are still, you know, having to choose between history and geography at such a young age. And to me, the two are so interrelated. It's just a false divide, you know, to have to make that choice.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a shame we don't have like a phone in or something like that. Can you imagine like the amount of teachers now ringing in to kind of give their two pennies on this? But yeah, I mean, I had this exact same dilemma when I was in high school. So I absolutely loved drama, because drama was a way of me safely expressing myself without outing myself, if you like, even though at the time I didn't know there was anything to come out from. But that's because of Section 28, and I've talked about it before and all that kind of thing. But anyway, I just felt like drama was like an amazing thing. But in my school, I was devastated to find out in my year 9 options that geography and drama only existed in one option block and in the same option block. So I could only take geography or drama. I couldn't take both.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I remember my English teacher, Mrs. Gunn, saying to me, like, because I remember being a bit upset saying, I can't do drama and geography. I can't do it. And she's like, well, and you could tell that she was frustrated by the system as well. Because as you know, hardly anyone takes drama, you know, especially in those days. So she was lucky to have get like 6-7 students perhaps or something like that. So but she never tried to force me to take drama. She just said, look, we run a drama class every lunchtime. Well, most lunchtimes, you know, once a week at least. You can still come to those, even though we use them to kind of like get through the GCSE and stuff like that. She said, you know, you'd be welcome to come to those. But, you know, what does your heart say you want to do? What do you really, you know, passionate about? And, you know, I almost tossed a coin for it. But I obviously, as people guessed, I ended up taking geography as a GCSE. But I've been utilizing drama like ever since, you know, and when I was a teacher, drama was my second subject. I taught after, you know, there was one year when after the main drama teacher, I taught the most hours of drama before any of the English teachers did. So, but yeah, it's, you're right. It is a flawed system, and it's just way too, it's just this continuation that education tries to put kids in boxes, you know, almost with the false sense of choice. I mean, we could definitely open a Pandora's box of discussion here and get on soapboxes here, but yeah, it's such a shame. And like, so do you think you would have, if you had the choice and you were able to do history and geography, if it was like at all possible, or is it just too many permutations and restrictions? I mean, it was never meant to be.
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously every school sort of manages it differently.
Yeah, there was
the option of doing two humanities. So the way it worked in my school was that, you know, you had to choose a technology, a sort of field technology, and then you had to choose a kind of an arts subject. So I actually did drama, and then you did a humanity. And so that was geography, RE, history. And then there was a fourth option, which was kind of they just sort of put in a lot, like all the extras, basically. So within that was you could do a second art subject or you could do a second humanity. But also within that one was the thing that I really, really loved at the time, which was the additional language.
I was
already doing French, but I loved Spanish. And so for me, the kind of the addition was the language, and like absolutely no regrets about taking Spanish, because obviously, you know, I've gone on to sort of say what a huge kind of impact that had on me in terms of like where I've ended up traveling. And ultimately that's what I did at university. So no regrets there. But yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, I would have like, I don't know, not done PE and geography as well or something like that.
Yeah, because I went to a Catholic school, so like we had to take, you know, we had core PE, and we had to take religious education. It was core in our school. So you had, and then you had to take a technology, and then that didn't leave much for much else, you know. So yeah, that's the way it went. Yes, you had to take a language, you had to take RE, you had to take a technology, and then I think that's why geography, history and drama was all lumped in one option block. What a big shame. But what I always tell when I used to advise kids, like I used to have a year 9 form group, or you know, year 9s thinking about what they want to do for GCSE, I never felt like I should have or had to like sell the subject. Like an options evening, it wasn't, look, you should take geography, you should take geography. I don't think I ever took that approach. It was all, well, what do you want to get out of the subject? What do you want when you finish school? Like, where are you heading? Like, and like, if you, you know, you're doing well in geography, but do you enjoy it? Like, if you woke up in the morning and you're having a bad morning, are you going to look at the timetable and go, oh, thank God, at least got geography? Or are you going to look at the timetable and go, oh, for God's sake, I've got geography? You know, that, because this is going to be the next 2 years of your life. So don't, and really, on the grand scheme of things, as you are proof right now, in the grand scheme of things, there are pathways back to things.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
So you never took geography GCSE, but you are now an academic in a geography department at the University of Newcastle. So
Exactly. I know. Yeah. I mean, I think this is the message that I would have for, you know, kids who are struggling with options as well, is like, don't think that your life has to be determined by, you know, the choices that you're making right now.
Yeah.
Exactly as you say, you know, there are always ways back, you know, there's always ways that you can keep exploring things outside of your formal classes, you know, like you were saying there, Kit, you know, with drama, like lunchtime club and stuff. And yeah, if you're passionate about something, you'll find a way to get back to it, I think.
100%. Yeah. Like me, I never took GCSE drama, but you know, I've definitely utilized that to the empty degree.
Yeah,
so,
for sure. Yeah.
I don't want to give too much away, but I have auditioned for a voice acting part in something, so we'll see how that goes. I'm not going to say too much because I probably won't get it, but you know, worth a try. But so what I will say is that you know, towards the end of last season, when I spoke to Katie Nicolau, the meteorologist, and last season, she's hilarious, and we did a bit of Star Trek improv voice drama, and it was just nuts. So I don't know if anyone would want to employ me as a voice actor, because that was just crazy off the wall. Right, fantastic. Let's go back to what we were mentioned about a bit earlier about, you know, the fact that you got this background where you've been, you know, exploring, you know, diverse landscapes, cultures, and your passion for things like climate change, because that's what really brought you on, brought us together, wasn't it? Which was absolutely delightful. Yeah. And I'm going to forever remember our collaboration fondly, Catherine, because it was absolutely brilliant. And that was the young people at a Crossroads project. And I know you're doing other things as well, but I've been waiting to talk about this project on this podcast for quite a while now. If you could so just summarize kind of like what you were trying to retrieve, what you were doing, and about how we went about it, because it was just such a lovely project.
I mean, it was absolutely brilliant to work with you on it, Kit, and yeah, in, well, there's tons I could say. I'll try and keep it short, and then we can sort of open up a little bit more. So Young People at a Crossroads, it was a two-year project that was conducted partly in Manchester, partly in Melbourne. And it was researching with young people aged 14 to 18 who were all migrant background. That was kind of the term I ended up with as the one that sort of fitted them best. Originally, I was planning to research exclusively with second generation young people, so young people who were born in one of, you know, the UK or Australia, but to parents who, where one of the parents had migrated or both had. As I started sort of, you know, recruiting for the research, I found that actually I was getting interest from some young people who themselves had migrated with parents, some who were second generation, and had a couple who were third generation. But the reason why I was, what I was talking to these young people about was their experiences of learning about climate change in the context where they now live, and in some cases, obviously, in other countries that they lived in as well. So I'd asked them all about, you know, sort of how they were learning about climate change, what, you know, what their concerns were relating to that, you know, how that education made them feel. But then for those who wanted to do it, and not all of them did, I invited them to set up an interview with a parent. And the parents were all, you know, had all grown up in a different country. And those interviews were just so fascinating. And I loved sitting in on them. So the young person would, we had like a sort of a few questions that we sort of encouraged them all to ask, you know, when was the first time you heard the term climate change? Were there any sort of environmental norms or behaviors that you found sort of odd or difficult to adjust to when you first moved? You know, what was the environment like where you grew up? So there are a few sort of set questions, but the young people would sort of take those interviews in the direction they wanted to. And then once they'd interviewed their parent, I'd then go back, and I should say that worked with a brilliant researcher called Ellen Van Holstein as well, who did a lot of the interviews in Melbourne. So Ellen or I would go back, all over Zoom, of course, and kind of get the young person, the parent, together to sort of reflect on that interview. You know, what did you learn? Did you talk about anything for the first time? What surprised you, etc. And then the sort of last stage was, I guess, sort of circling back to that first interview that the young person had done, thinking, right, you know, thinking about the way that you learn about climate change, the kind of content that's coming up, you know, the stories that are coming up, the concerns that are being foregrounded, how does that fit with how your parent talked about the place where they grew up and their experiences of, you know, living with kind of different environmental challenges, whether they were called or related to climate change or not? And that was like, it was so interesting then to just kind of watch sometimes the penny dropping of kind of, oh yeah, you know, we've been learning about climate change for this many years and we've never talked about, you know, kind of deforestation. Well, actually deforestation was quite a common topic, so that's a bad example, but you know, we've never talked about sort of charcoal use in Zambia, for example. You know, that's a really big issue that is driving deforestation, but is really important to, and the only option for a lot of households in Zambia. So actually just watching, you know, in that case, a young woman called Siobhan, who'd been talking about, you know, charcoal use with her mum, like kind of thinking, well, okay, why have we never talked about this? And maybe we talked about it as, you know, a problem that's fueling climate change, but we haven't talked about it in regards to actually how our community members on the ground sort of responding to this, coping with this, etc. So, so the research really was about kind of working intergenerationally and cross-culturally with those young people and their parents to really think about how education systems, I guess, can kind of maybe teach climate change in ways that are more informed by different knowledges, different stories, different perspectives. And for those young people taking part in the research, I guess kind of, and their parents, like trying to sort of validate those as like, this, these are really important things that could feed into you and actually enhance climate change education. And then of course, once we'd done all of that, we got that, you know, those amazing interviews, we encouraged the young people to write about those. And that was where you came in, Kit, and Nerida Jolly as well in Melbourne, of when we started to get these amazing reflections back from the young people, and we were putting them together into this, you know, what we called the creative book, which was the reflections from the young people and then also kind of sort of thematic summaries from across the project. And of course, a really huge part of that work was working with Maisie as well, this incredible illustrator who did a unique illustration for each of the young people's reflections. And so, that was the point that you were working on the project, was when we were putting all of that together into this into this book that is now, you know, it's been downloaded, you know, more than 600 times and is being used by teachers in different countries and, you know, just read by people who have an interest in the topic as well. I guess your role was really like, well, the four of us together thinking about how we've got this amazing stuff. How do we communicate it in a really engaging way?
Yeah, it was such a delight to work on. And I remember when you sent me kind of like the draft. And I was just absolutely captivated in like just reading all the way through it and what these young people were saying. And I just love the way how it was structured as well, about how you had young people's reflections and their discussions kind of in kind of sort of like themes, but then like spread out throughout the book, you also had like these general thoughts and discussions where you're kind of collating and pulling common threads together, and that makes it really, really accessible. And then of course, the work that we then did was then having like the teacher's guide to it and things like that. And I think when we presented it at the Geographical Association conference, was it last year, I think? You know, it seemed to have gone down really well with the teachers in the room. And yeah, to hear that you just say, I mean, I never knew that actually, that it had been downloaded over 600 times. And that's just from, I guess that's just from the official website, because there's other ways of accessing it. So it's probably been, you know, I would say over 1,000 times, which is quite incredible, really, that it's been utilized in that way.
Mm. Yeah, no, for sure. And those statistics, that was kind of a couple of months ago as well. So, yeah, could even be more now.
Absolutely, 100%. So, and the one thing which was really cool about it as well is that you had this, like, these 10 things, these 10 key messages that have come through that the young people, and this is something I know that we are both passionate about and a lot of people listen to passionate about, is giving young people a voice. And I can't remember all these 10 things off the top of my head, but can you remember maybe two or three of like the top 10 messages that came off? I mean, I'm going to put a link in the description for people to investigate this themselves, but what was the, can you name some of the top 10?
I mean, I've got the book next to me, so I could cheat and look at that. But I'm actually going to say the ones that really come to me, because those are obviously the ones that have had an impact on me, and hopefully, kind of, you know, would have an impact on others. So obviously that point of like just, you know, really listening to young people, listening to their concerns, not discounting their emotions. And the emotions of the teachers who are having to teach on this topic as well. So that was definitely one thing, is kind of voice and emotion. Obviously, sort of just because of, you know, how I've just explained the project and sort of how it came about, I guess also just the validating of diverse stories. So that was something that I always wanted to come across in the research, and it really strongly did. And then I think this, the kind of key point for me, and this has really sort of taken me forward into the work that I'm now doing at Newcastle University, is thinking about climate justice. And what does climate justice mean to young people? And this wasn't originally kind of in the research proposal as like a real sort of driving theme. But I think just by merit of the time that the research took place and like you know, in the time between me writing that proposal and it actually taking place, you know, we'd had COVID, we'd had, you know, the George Floyd murder, we'd had, you know, all kinds of different events, global events that really kind of flagged up different injustices and how they're all kind of interconnected. And justice was, you know, it was really kind of on, I think, on a lot of young people's minds, on everyone's minds. But, and of course, the project and all of my research has always been very driven by the idea of intergenerational justice. So, you know, climate change is like, I can't think of a better issue that sort of sums up intergenerational justice.
Totally agree.
You know,
like, yeah.
Why do we even care about this stuff if not for, you know, younger and future generations, right? So justice was really kind of central to the project. And one activity that I didn't talk about so much in the project, but when I was sort of explaining it, was like between the original interview and then the interviews with parents, we did a focus group and we had these images. We had about 7 images of kind of different things relating to climate change. You know, we had like the classic polar bear, you know, in the Arctic, and like, you know, we had sort of like a wildfire. But we had a few images that were much more like focused on like responses to climate change and people holding up banners saying climate justice. And I just started noticing that the young people were really engaged by these images. And I would ask them, you know, what does climate justice mean to you? I'd ask them that at the end of the first interview they did. And then when we'd done this, like looking at all these images and things, discussing them together, I'd say again, you know, have you got any more of a, you know, idea around climate justice and like, you know, kind of what does that mean to you now? And like seeing kind of again the penny drop as they were thinking more and more about it. And the way that we distilled that down in that top 10 messages is like climate justice rather than climate change being kind of what education is about. So not just educating young people about climate change as in events and, you know, kind of changes to the planet that have already taken place and that will continue to take place because of things that have done, that have already happened in the past, that they're now sort of living through and in many ways feel powerless to kind of, you know, to change. But so that would be sort of climate change. But climate justice being more, okay, this is the situation we're in and we need to be thinking about what we can do about it. So actually making, rather than the focus of any education on sort of on climate being how it's changed and, you know, how we're still going to keep seeing, you know, the legacy of that and how terrible it all is, actually, like, what are the justice aspects to this? You know, how are people being affected differently? What are the options for people? How are people kind of, you know, galvanizing and coming together and contesting this? So, and to me, I think that's what I want to keep looking at in my research is what does climate justice mean to different young people in different parts of the world? They might have completely different opinions about what it is, what it looks like, but that can be like a point of action. And, you know, that's sort of inspiring and kind of empowering in a way that just learning about climate change is not.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, this is why me and you get on quite well, you know. but it's what I will add to that is that you as you know, there's a project I'm working on that hopefully I'll be able to release at some point in the near future, you know, where the third element of the systematic kind of approach that I'm going to be using to help teachers is that the third element of this systematic approach is the focus on climate justice because it's scientifically mandated. You know, it is the IPCC actually have used words to the effect to say the climate change issue is a climate justice issue and mentions marginalized people, indigenous people, all that kind of stuff. We're definitely seeing off the same hinge. And again, folks, you know, and I know there's a certain kind of worldview of people who maybe, you know, who listen to this podcast in particular, because they would have switched off quite a while ago otherwise. But you know, it's what I hope that comes across when we have these kind of discussions, that it's, you know, a lot of this is just simply based on two things. One is talking to people and listening to them. And the second thing is, you know, the research and evidence that's gone on behind folks, whether it's physical science or social sciences. And what I really love about the work that you've done as well, Catherine, and the work that you're moving into, is that in a sense, it, you know, it's not, I've got this, you know, hypothesis, I've got this goal, I've got these certain key performance indicators or these things that I've got to meet. You've discovered something that young people are really hooked upon. You know, as I say, number nine of your top 10 is young people want to focus on climate justice education, not climate change education, right? And now you're thinking, the young people have told me this, this is something we need to pursue. So it's almost as if, as though, you know, in by proxy, the young people are kind of like influencing the next stage of your research. And that must be, and if there's any young people listening, I really hope they feel quite empowered by hearing that. The fact that, you know, that there are, yes, the education system, you know, and we know there are flaws to the academic sector and all that kind of stuff. Of course there are, you know, but I hope that gives people hope to think that there are plenty of academics out there like you who are listening and who are engaging in research in order to give more of a voice to a more of a platform to young people, for example. It's like you yourself is definitely someone who I'd count in that, you know, climate scientists like Catherine Hayhoe and, you know, who are very, very young people focused. So yeah, it really does. It's another thing that adds to my element of hope in this whole situation.
Yeah. Oh, good. You know? Yeah.
So, yeah. So folks, if you look down in the show notes in the description, please, you'll have links to all these kind of stuff. And the Young People at a Crossroads project is completely, all the resources for it are completely free to access. That's the book, the education book, its PDF version, the teacher's notes, the next steps, videos, everything that's been done. You know, if you want to set up your own thing in school for interview techniques, actually links in very, very well with Chantal Mayer Holloway's and Akira Williams Young Voices Project. Voices Project. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to start a Young Voices thing, you can combine the Voices Project and this project together. That, you know, is there's so much good stuff that you can springboard off, folks. So use it. That's what it's there for.
Are you a business or organization passionate about ethical practices, products, and systems? Is being sustainable, inclusive, and equitable core to your values? And do you want to spread the word amongst listeners who share these ideals? Then sponsor the Coffee and Geography podcast. There are pricing options to suit a range of needs, and you know you are supporting independent educational efforts that aligns with your aims. Visit bit.ly/coffee/geog/sponsor for more details.
We're going to bring this wonderful conversation to a close now with We Are All Geographers. So we're going to get you to link back to our previous guest, who was Andrew Kane, the author Andrew Kane, who's a science teacher but wrote some comedic but educational books about marine biology, which are quite popular, done quite well on Amazon. Now, Andy's gone a bit outside of the box because it's meant to be like single words, you know, maybe two at the most, right? So, for example, Shabnam, who was the guest before Andrew, gave him the word HDMI, right? And he actually did a beautiful, wonderful teacher thing. He was like, you know, the bleeding annoyances with HDMI. There's never a cable around. And he went on that, right? So when I asked him for his single word for you, Catherine, he went for shopping trolleys with dodgy wheels.
Okay,
how's
great.
That for outside the box? So basically, I'm not quite sure how you're going to approach this. I usually say try and link it to geography, but then again, you know, I think 30 seconds on this just in general is going to be interesting.
Okay, so I'll do my best.
Your topic is chopping trolleys with dodgy wheels, you know, because they do seem to be quite prevalent, to be honest, don't they? I mean, more than we would like.
Yeah.
So when you're ready, Catherine, I'll start the 30-second timer for you to talk about shopping trolleys with dodgy wheels.
Okay.
Go for it.
Right. So shopping trolleys with dodgy wheels are really annoying because normally when you get into the supermarket, you know, you've got a set of things that you really want to buy and, you know, you're on a bit, sometimes you've got limited time and you just want to, you know, get to those places as soon as possible. The shopping trolley will take you off in different directions. But, you know, maybe there is a bit of a metaphor for life here because sometimes we're very like single-minded about the thing that we think we want to do, but actually events, outside experiences conspire to take us in different directions and maybe we end up getting something more interesting along the way.
Oh my God, I love the trajectory you took that, and that wasn't a pun, folks, trajectory. That was brilliant. Nicely done, Catherine, nicely done. And and Andrew, if you were doing that to be for any nefarious purpose, because you think I'm gonna upset the shopping cart, see what I did there, then I think Catherine's just smashed it. Sorry, Andrew. Well done. Right. Unfortunately, we can't go back in time and get one back on Andy, but you can come up with something for our future guest. So have you got a particular word or dare I say, as Andy set a precedent with a whole phrase, but a word would be good. Or a couple of words.
I'm thinking about... Again, just like, you know, we were talking about Maisie and her illustrations and how gorgeous they were and how that really opened up the book. I'm going to say illustration.
Nice.
You know, because there's quite a bit you can do with that. You know, you can take it quite literally or that, you know, it can be a bit more of like kind of, you know, the idea of what illustrates what. So, yeah, illustration. And if Maisie's listening, you know, that's a little like just homage to how amazing her book is.
Oh, I'm full of admiration of Maisie. She actually popped up a lovely surprise in the Geography Teacher Educators Conference.
Nice.
Because she also was illustrating another climate change. I think it was Climate Change Action something she was doing, and she'd made these little postcards.
And Lizzie Rushton's.
Lizzie Rushton's project with Linda Dunlop, I think.
So
Lizzie, I know you're listening. Lizzie, you're going to come on the podcast at some point, aren't you? Yeah, get in touch. Yeah. Okay, we just done a shout out there to Maisie, to Lizzie. A shout out also to James Riding, who your new colleague in Newcastle, who was on a few weeks ago and was absolutely
he's brilliant. Amazing work, that mapping project and the subject of mapping. Wasn't it? Yeah. Listen back to that one if you haven't had a chance yet.
Yeah. Have you got anyone else you'd like to say hi to?
I feel like we should say hi to Narada because she was kind of the third part of, and hopefully Narada Jolly will also be interviewed at some stage. So Narada works for, in fact, I don't think she does anymore, but at the time she worked for Environment Education Victoria, which kind of big sort of environmental education organization, works with primary and mostly primary, I think, and some secondary schools across state of Victoria and Australia, and just a really, really passionate, just like EKIT, like a real like passionate formal educator but still educating, you know, informally in all kinds of ways, and a real like kind of activist as well for climate justice.
We'll go with that. So hi, Narada. Well, I'll be in touch soon. we'll work out the time difference. Okay, and finally, so where can folks find you if they want to kind of connect with you? So I know that you're on, and I'm going to keep calling it Twitter because, you know, no reason. So where, I know you're on Twitter. Well, so where can people find you?
Yeah, so Twitter at @C_L_Walker. Obviously, you can Google Catherine Walker, Newcastle University. That should bring up my homepage. The YPAC resources are actually going to be migrating sometime soon.
Okay.
So currently, I know that you're going to put the current website for them in the links at the bottom, but yeah, watch this space for, they're going to be sort of migrating to a platform at Newcastle University sometime soon. I would say that looking at the YPAT resources is a great way of kind of getting into my research as well.
Awesome. Well, Catherine, it's always a delight to talk to you and catch up and everything like that, and it's just been so lovely getting to know you and your work over the last couple of years. And yeah, and I'm just so, so excited to see where the next phases of your research and your projects go next. And I'll look forward to seeing you in April at the GA conference.
Yes, yeah, looking forward to it too. Thank you so much. This has been brilliant. And thanks for just indulging all of my travel stories and things like that.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter at @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.